Thanks. It's a great honor to be here. I was talking to a sociologist friend of mine in Princeton, Mitch Denier, who spent the early part of his career here in Santa Barbara. And there was an event in Princeton that he was going to be at and I wasn't going to be at tonight. I said, you know, I'm not going to be there because I'm going to be in Santa Barbara for a memorial event for Walter. And his response was, ah, I remember him from the number 24 bus. Yeah. And I realized that although I had gotten to know, my first encounter with Walter was when he sent me a telegram, which some of you will know what that is, offering me a position as a postdoc at the ITP. So that goes back 30 plus years. And I can't do quite as well as Steve Kivelson, but it is true that the connection reaches back a little further, or at least the fates reach back a little further, since my late father-in-law was Keith Bruckner, who was the first chair of the physics department at UC San Diego and brought Walter to the West Coast. And so Walter was a fixture of my wife's childhood in La Jolla. I realized that in the last decade, the vast majority of my conversations with Walter were also on the number 24 bus. So we would come for a visit during part of the year, and with wonderful good fortune, I would sometimes find that my time for going back into town was the same as Walter's, and we would share, it was roughly 20 minutes, which is actually not that much shorter than the amount of time for this talk. So, what I thought I would do is to speak, as I would have with Walter on the bus, about what I'm worried about right now, as opposed to trying to frame something more grand. I should say that Walter's supportiveness over the years meant an enormous amount to me. As some of you may know, when my mentors decided that having me here as a postdoc would be an interesting idea, interesting experiment, I guess, from their point of view. The interaction in physics and biology was not in the state that it is today. And it was really quite formative for me. And Walter, as Jim said in his introduction, he was passionately honest. And forced all of us, I think, to confront things in ways that we might otherwise have been happy to gloss over. So it's a little bit, then also a few words about what keeps me up at night. So in contrast to when I first came here as a postdoc, if you're a physicist interested in biological phenomena, there's this fantastic thing that now so much of the living world is accessible to quantitative physics-style experiments, in many cases, not coincidentally, actually done by experimental physicists. Many of the things that we were all curious about long ago, which seemed very speculative, are now concrete research programs. And that's fantastic. The challenge is that as the experiments explode, the pressure to stay close to experiment sometimes causes us to lose track of the fact that theoretical physics is also a somewhat more grand enterprise than just explaining the most recent data. And so that tension between the grand and the general, and you know, it's also true that when it works, we also get all the details right. And sort of trying to go back and forth between those two things is something that I spend a lot of my time worrying about. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you about where we are on two efforts of this flavor. So one is about the attempt to do, if you will, the statistical mechanics of real biological networks. So many of you are familiar with ideas, let's say, in thinking about the emergence of order in a flock of birds, or the use of statistical mechanics ideas to think about neural networks, and so on. And there's clearly, behind that, there's all of the power and vision that we have in statistical physics, and then there's the confrontation with real examples from biological systems and the question of whether we can actually bring those into contact with one another. And so I'm going to talk about one recent example, which is a collaboration with our experimentalist friends, but I hope you'll see that where we're going is that we really can sort of start from something reasonably general and drive all the way down to engage with the details, which then allows us to step back and ask where we are. And I won't spend much time on the where we are, but just try to give you a flavor for that. And then the other idea is something that I've been interested in for much longer, which is this fact that there are many examples in the functioning of biological systems, particularly in our sensory systems, but also in many other examples, where the performance of the biological system is close to some basic physical limit. So the canonical example is the ability of the visual system to count single photons. And there is an idea, which many of us have spent time thinking about, which is that when you see this, you should be able to turn the argument around and ask what features of the real system are essential for approaching that physical limit. So can I turn the observation of close to optimal performance into an optimization principle from which we can derive things, much in the way that we use variational principles in the rest of physics? And so this will be an example from thinking about networks of neurons, and this will be an example from thinking about networks of genes. So many of you have seen the idea of trying to describe a network of neurons in statistical mechanics terms using some sort of Ising model. You imagine that neurons can be either on or off. Now, that could be some coarse-grained statement about their activity, or it could be a very precise statement that in one little window of time, either the neuron generates an action potential or it doesn't. So that in some way it's natural to think about the states of individual neurons as being binary. If I have a large collection of binary variables, they're all interacting with each other in some complicated way. I want to do statistical mechanics. I want to write down something like an Ising model. Of course, a milestone in this was the work by John Hopfield, in which he tried to write down a dynamical model which captured some aspects of reality, although not all of it, and argued that you could get from that dynamical model at least to a Lyapunov function, which you might think of as being promoted to an energy if the system were noisy. The deterministic version had a Lyapunov function, and it doesn't take much imagination to imagine that the noisy version of that dynamics would degenerate something like the Boltzmann distribution. And so this is a view which says you want to start with the underlying dynamics and then show that you get out something that is familiar. There's an alternative view, which is to say that if you observe a system and you can measure, for instance, the average activity of each neuron, so the expectation value of the individual binary variables, the individualizing variables, and you can measure the first signature that they're interacting with each other, namely that they're correlated with each other in pairs, and you can measure that correlation matrix, then if I ask you to build a model that describes the states of the system as a whole, you could ask for the model that reproduces those experimental quantities but otherwise has as little structure as possible. So that if you draw states out of the model, they'll be as random as they can be, but still agree with experiment on the expectation values for the individual neural activities and the correlations. And so, of course, that's the problem of building a model with maximum entropy. Remember that there's no energy in this system, so the things that you're constraining, if you had the maximum entropy consistent with the average energy, you'd be describing a system in thermal equilibrium. Here you're asking for the maximum entropy distribution consistent with an entire correlation matrix and a vector of expectation values. Energy doesn't come into it. This is not thermal equilibrium. It's just an attempt to generate an approximation to the underlying probability distribution. And the fact that you could think about it this way wouldn't be useful if it wasn't for the fact that you can now observe many neurons simultaneously. So the spirit here is that you're trying to give some statistical mechanics-like description of the collective behavior of the network as a whole, driven by a small set of experimental observations that you could hope are the relevant quantities. So there's an intuition that these are the relevant things, and then you're going to ask how far that can take you. And you realize that you then have to solve an inverse problem. I tell you the values of the correlations and of the expectation values. You have to determine the couplings. But then once you've done that, there are no free parameters. So what's a context in which we're trying to think about this? Since neurons, their activity is electrical, you might think that the way you observe the activity of neurons is to use electrodes, and you can do that. And that's what's been done for nearly a century. There are now other things you can do using the modern sort of convergence of tools from molecular biology and actually fairly high-end tabletop experimental physics. So what you do is you genetically engineer a mouse so that every neuron in its brain, or a selected subset of neurons, expresses a protein whose fluorescence depends on the concentration of calcium. And whenever neurons are active, calcium flows in and out, so monitoring the calcium concentration gives you a slightly coarse-grained view of the electrical activity. And then you can literally see the patterns of electrical activity in a large population of neurons. Remember, neurons are pretty small, so you need a rather high-resolution microscope. You're looking through a scattering material, namely the brain itself, so you want to think about how you're going to do your microscopy, and the trade-offs tell you that if you did two-photon microscopy rather than one-photon microscopy, you would do much better, and so you need to build a scanning two-photon microscope. And in many regions of the brain, nothing interesting happens unless the animal is behaving, and so you'd like to be able to look through a microscope at things which are roughly a micron in size, but you'd like the animal to still be able to do something and move around. So my colleague, David Tank, built this fantastic instrument in which the mouse runs on, I don't have a pointer. Is there a stick? There's one of these things, a laser pointer. I don't know. It's hard to read anyway. Oh, this thing, yes. Aha. Very good. Green. But you do need to turn it on, yes. That seems plausible. And the switch is on the side. Very good. So what you see here, a little hard to see. There's a styrofoam ball here, and it's floating in air, held up by a column of air, and its motion is being monitored, and there's a little mouse that stands on top of it and can run. But his head is fixed so that you can look into his brain. But as he runs, you monitor what the ball is doing, and you then can calculate how he would have moved through the world, and then you can generate virtual reality for him, so that he thinks he's running through the world. All the while looking at the neurons, which have been lit up. Sorry, this is a very bad reproduction. This is what one snapshot looks like. Of course, if I had a movie, which would decrease the probability that the whole presentation would work, which is why I don't like to use them, you would see, for example, that these individual cells that are currently bright would actually flicker on and off as the mouse was running around doing its thing. And as he moves along, let's say if a simple experiment, he's just running along a linear track, and you record in the part of the brain that contains the famous place cells, which were discovered by John O'Keefe 40-some-odd years ago, for which he shared the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago. And these are cells that when the mouse runs along a track, they fire in sequence because they are active at moments when the mouse is in particular places. However, if you actually record in an unbiased way from large numbers of neurons, there are lots of other so those neurons do something predictable as he runs down the track, but there's a large collection of other neurons that are doing something else, who knows. If you look, for example, you can look at the average of activity of each of these neurons, that's not particularly interesting. You can look at the pattern of correlations. As you might expect, neurons that are active when the mouse is at nearby places are positively correlated. Neurons that are active at very different places are negatively correlated, but the correlation pattern spreads out in some complicated way through all of these things, it is what it is. So the question is, if I had a real magnet and I measured the pairwise correlations among the spins, and I went through this exercise. Or in fact, if I measured some small set, the expectation value of some small set of relevant operators, and I built the maximum entropy model consistent with that, I'd actually get a correct description of all the macroscopic behavior. So can I do that here? So you go through the exercise. We don't know which operators are relevant, so we're just going to try some. And then the question is, does it work? And let me emphasize again that, as you know, the number of parameters in the Ising model is the same as the number of these expectation values, so there's nothing left for you to fit or adjust. So what happens? Well, we built a model in which we took as input from the data correlations between pairs of neurons. So the first thing you might try is to predict correlations among triplets of neurons. Now remember, you should be careful, there's 100,000 of them in this population, 100,000 triplets. You clearly can't measure them all independently of each other, but if you ask about individual ones, you get reasonable error bars, and you find that the predicted and experimental and observed values overlap. And in fact, if you ask about the typical scale of your prediction errors from the model versus the typical scale of your measurement errors, you find that they're essentially the same. You can't, and of course, you can't do better than that. What could happen, of course, is that somehow your model was overfitting the data, and then your prediction errors would actually be smaller than your experimental errors, and that would be a sign that you'd done something terribly wrong. But we didn't. And an interesting thing is that if you take the conventional biological point of view, which is that these neurons are representing the position of the animal, you can then predict what the correlations would be as well, right? So you just calculate from the data what's the probability that the neuron is active when the animal is in this particular position, and then multiply all those probabilities together and do the right average, and then you find that your predictions actually have essentially, well, there's a slight positive correlation between predictions and observations, but actually in the bulk, they're almost uncorrelated with each other. So in fact, the conventional view doesn't describe the correlations in the network as a whole at all, which was an enormous surprise to us, whereas this simple Ising model actually does. Now, if you think that the behavior is really collective, then one of the signs of collective behavior is that the individual degrees of freedom aren't, by definition, they're not independent of each other. And so, you know, think about a magnet. If I tell you the configuration of all the spins in the magnet except for one, you can tell me whether the probability that spin will be up or down, given the effective field that's applied by all the other spins. So you do that calculation, and you, of course, if you're right, then you'll just get, well, if you said it the right way, it would be the hyperbolic tangent, but of course, this is a probability, so it runs between 0 and 1, so it's, what is it, 1/2 of 1 plus the hyperbolic tangent. And so you can then walk through the data, and at every moment for every neuron, you can ask, what is the effective field acting on this neuron, and was it active or not? You bin together all the cases where you had the same effective field, and you ask, what was the probability it was active? And, you know, it's pretty good. Now, we actually are trying to think about whether that difference, which is statistically significant, is a sign that we're missing something, which you could argue is progress all by itself. I think there was a time when if you presented this, you would argue that, well, you know, it's good enough for biology. I really don't like that argument, and so we're still thinking about whether that near miss actually means something. But this is an average over all neurons in all time. You can unfold this and ask neuron by neuron, moment by moment, if you look at all the other neurons in the network, you have a prediction for the probability that this neuron will be active. And if you do that, you find that for all the neurons, it's very peaky, right? Most of the time you predict the neurons should be silent, and every once in a while you get a little blip where you think the neuron should be active. Now, in this case, it's not terribly surprising. Those blips correspond to the moments when the animal runs through a particular position along the track. And indeed, in that case, you get it right. That's when the neuron was active. What's interesting is that here, the runs through the track are indicated by these colored regions. And here you can see that the blips are not at particular places, particular moments during the run. But nonetheless, with few exceptions, you're still, and those are, you know, those are those little errors there. You're still getting it right. You're predicting when the neuron should be active, given the state of all the other neurons. So what this is telling you is that not only does the classical description fail to describe the correlations in the network, the Ising description gives you a picture of collective activity of the network in which the place cells and the other cells, which creatively are referred to as non-place cells, are on equal footing, and in fact, the collective behavior, you sort of can't really tell them apart. And in fact, you can do more than that. You can focus on the place cells, which you would say, well, everybody understands these. Of course, the understanding is that they should fire when the animal is in a particular place. And if that's true, then the probability of firing should basically follow the same sequence as the animal runs through the track each time, because he's running at almost constant speed. But you'll notice that if you look at the real activity, every once in a while there's a run where several of them just miss. And if you go and compute the probability of being active for all these neurons as a function of time from this model, you discover that they should have missed. So we even in the place where, even in for the subset of cells whose behavior conforms to the classical picture, the collective description in terms of an Ising model is giving you something that you couldn't get from the classical view. So for us, what we think we've done here is to convince ourselves that you really can do this. I mean, the models that were written down, let's say by Hopfield, you know, now 30 plus years ago, it wasn't clear whether these were supposed to be sort of metaphors for what's really going on, or whether you should take them seriously as theories from which you could actually calculate things. And of course, depending on the answer to that question, you would, you know, that takes you in different directions. And so I hope that this kind of result tells you, no, these really are theories from which you can calculate things and get the details right. And so this then gives you license to ask, okay, I have a statistical mechanics description of this network. Where am I in the phase diagram? Is this like other models that I know about, and so on? And that's a whole set of questions that we and other people are trying to think about. But this connection between the general and the particular was the thing that we've been focused on for the last year or so. And so that's what I would have talked about with Walter on the bus. So let me give you one more example in the same spirit, completely different system. That problem was one where I think all of our thinking has been data-driven. In that it's the opportunity to look at these experiments when you record from many neurons simultaneously that sharpens a lot of the questions. So the alternative is to try and think sort of from principles down. And so consider as an example a genetic network. There's some signal in the outside world, or maybe even internal to the organism, that is encoded by affecting the concentrations of, in a direct way, for various signaling molecules, which then feed into some complicated network of genes that interact with each other. And so what you should think of here is that this is a protein molecule which activates the reading out, the expression of this gene. So that's why there's an arrow. The product of this gene is a protein which then represses the synthesis of this protein, and so on reciprocally. And you know, many of you have seen diagrams like this, at least from a distance. And the problem, of course, is that these are immensely complicated. And as physicists, we have an aversion to the many parameters that are required to describe these systems. And an idea which we and other people have thought about is that in many of these situations, a measure of how well the system is doing is how much information actually finds its way from these input signals to the concentrations of the proteins at the output end. And in many cases, this really matters. That information is information about something that the organism really cares about, and you know that you can't transmit arbitrarily large amounts of information because these molecules are present at surprisingly low concentrations, and even in many cases at low absolute molecular counts. And so the noise associated with the random behavior of the individual molecules sets a limit to how much information you can transmit. And so you might guess that there's been pressure to transmit as much information as possible given that limited number of molecules. By the way, there's a very interesting question, which is, why don't you just use more molecules? To which I don't think anybody knows the answer. But if you take the thick number of molecules as being a constraint, there's two ways that you can try and push more information through the system. One is a sort of classical one that communication theorists tell us about, right? If I give you a communication channel and it has some fixed characteristics, I can transmit more information through it by having the distribution of inputs match the characteristics of the communication channel. So that would say the distribution of these molecules should somehow match the characteristics of this network. And then the other possibility, of course, is that even with a limited number of molecules, I could rearrange or tune these interactions so as to transmit more information. And again, we and other people are working on trying to develop theories in this spirit, but and the hope is that we'll eventually get this to the point where it's a quantitative theory of what these networks are doing. You know, you can be more or less optimistic about that, but you know, you might worry, this is all predicated on the notion the organism is actually using all the information. So how do you know that it's doing that? So again, let's dive into an example. And this is from the early stages in development of a fruit fly. A fruit fly is about 0.5 millimeter long. For the early stages, the duplication of cells is so fast that there are essentially no walls or membranes between the cells. So you have the closest to the physicist's idealization of development happening in a box. There are molecules whose concentrations are determined essentially by the mother when she makes the egg, that then vary. There are sources for these molecules at cardinal points in the embryo, and as a result, they have concentrations that vary in position. So if you think of X from the previous slide as actually being position, then these are the three sort of input molecules, and they feed into a network of several genes that interact with each other. In particular, if you're interested mostly in the sort of middle 80% of the embryo, then there are four molecules that are dominant, and these interact with each other in some complicated way to produce spatial patterns in concentration, which are shown here using antibody staining. And then there's another layer in which you could ask, well, okay, how do I know what the system, as it were, thinks about all these signals? And the answer is these signals feed into another layer, and they make, for instance, these beautiful striped patterns of concentration of particular molecules. This one is called Eve, and not because of Adam, I think, but it's an abbreviation for Even Skipped. And these periodic striped patterns are a sort of harbinger of the segmented body plan of the insect that will emerge from the embryo. So you can think of these as being a sort of readout of the information that's encoded here, which of course eventually becomes real macroscopic behavior. So if you think that information is encoded at this level and that the organism actually cares about it, you could say, well, how would you read it out if you wanted to make maximal use of the information that's available? And the answer is that if you're sitting at one point and you can observe the concentration of each of these molecules, then that concentration varies with position, but it's noisy, and that's a property of the network, but it's something that understanding exactly what molecular features of the network give rise to this distribution is complicated, but trying to characterize the distribution itself is not so bad. You can measure the mean, you can measure the covariance matrix, you can check whether being Gaussian is a good approximation, and so on. There's, of course, the probability distribution of positions along the length of the embryo, but that's uniform, and then there's a normalizing factor, and then this is just Bayes' rule that tells you that if you observe these concentrations of the molecules, then what you know about position is that it's drawn from this probability distribution. And again, let me emphasize that if you're willing to accept the experimental characterization of this distribution, then there's no free parameters here. So suppose you go through this exercise, and then you say, well, I'm going to pay attention to one gene, and if I'm sitting at some particular point and I try to find this probability distribution of positions that are consistent with the concentration that I observe at that point, well, if it's this gene and you pick that point, you're kind of in trouble because the concentration is low and that doesn't tell you very much. You could be in the front, you could be in the back, it's very blurry. On the other hand, if you get in this region where there's a nice steep slope, then you're pretty sure where you are, except there's an ambiguity whether you're on the front part or the back part. If you start paying attention to more and more of the genes, by the time you get to four, it's almost completely unambiguous, and there's a very tight distribution around the diagonal, which means that you can read out the position to an accuracy of about 1%, which turns of the total length of the embryo, which turns out to be the precision with which various things happen, such as, for example, the positioning of these stripes. So that encourages you to think, yes, I do actually have my hands on the information that the organism cares about. But that's consistency. It doesn't show you directly that the animal's using it. So this is a fruit fly, and there's generations of genetics that's been done on these. And so you can make various interesting mutant flies. And in particular, you can delete one of these maternal inputs, leaving this whole network intact, but changing its inputs. And if you use the same, if you make a mutant which is, as it turns out, rather gentle, then what happens is that what was this nice straight line gets bent a little bit. And so what that says is that if you were a cell sitting at this point, then if you based your behavior on the concentration of these molecules and you read those signals out using all the information that's available in the conditional probability distribution, you would conclude that you're a little bit closer to the center than you thought, than you really are. Okay? A small quantitative effect. On the other hand, in a different mutant, and all of these molecules have names, and I'm going to see if I can give the rest of the talk without using them, because this is a physics talk. This one's sort of interesting. Now, this was apparently much more serious. Both of these are the deletion of one molecule, one species. In this case, if you try to read out the information, well, back here, you're not doing so badly. You're off by 20% or so, and you've got the wrong slope, so that's a little weird. But what's really strange is that in the front of the near the head, what would be the head if the fly developed normally, you actually are sort of backwards. You think that the front is the back, and you think the axis is running the wrong way. So that's a pretty dramatic prediction. How would you test it? Well, the animal makes these stripes. And so you could say that if you're a cell sitting at this point, and your inference from the concentrations is the optimal inference that we wrote down, then you would conclude that you're actually at a position that in the normal embryo corresponds to making a stripe. So you should make a stripe, and you do. Whereas for these guys, you should put the stripes in the wrong place, right? Because this is a little bit shifted off the axis. And in fact, in this example, where the perturbations are smaller, you can follow not just the stripes in this particular gene, but there are three different ones that you can follow, and you can see that they actually trace out the ridge of maximal probability, suggesting that the fly's interpretation of where it is the one that you would get by making use of all the available information. This one is also more interesting. What I've shown is the average over many embryos of this ridge, which is actually quite dim, and the reason it's quite dim is that it's actually variable from embryo to embryo. And in here, what you actually find is that if you try to find the place at which the fifth stripe should occur, sometimes it doesn't actually cross. That is to say, there is no point in the embryo that has a pattern of gene expression consistent with being at this position. And so there is no stripe, or you would predict there to be no stripe, and sometimes there is. And in fact, in this region, you find that the stripes are actually variable, which, by the way, never happens in the normal embryo. And even more strongly, this stripe is actually a duplicate of this one. And since this is a biological detail, it turns out that you can tell the difference between, let's say, that stripe and that stripe, because they're actually regulated by different pieces of DNA. And we know that this stripe is in fact a duplicate of that one, as opposed to being a shifted version of that one. So what we think we've shown is that the sort of any attempt to build a theory in which you take seriously the information that flows through the network has deep inside it these probability distributions. And you might ask, actually for a long time we never bothered unfolding that information. And it was the insistence of our colleague Eric Fischhaus, who's one of the heroes of the subject, that, you know, we ought somehow to be able to make all of this explicit, that led us to ask, well, you know, almost as a sanity check, are these probability distributions that sit inside our calculation something that the organism actually cares about? And so by unfolding them, what we find is, yes, to a remarkable extent, by looking at those probability distributions, you get a predictive theory of how the organism will behave when you make genetic perturbations, which is certainly not where we started. And again, part of this is that there is this extraordinary precision that the system exhibits. And if you trace the calculations through, you can show that that precision comes ultimately from precision in the absolute levels of these concentrations. For example, these shifts, if you thought that all that mattered was the relative concentrations, you wouldn't get the predictions of these shifts right. Or if you thought that all that mattered was whether these genes were on or off, you similarly wouldn't be able to generate any of these predictions. So what I hope to have shown you, and what I would have hoped to convince Walter in our bus ride, is that we are actually at a moment where the things that are inside our theoretical constructs can be connected to the data in great detail, and that that gives us some license to take those things seriously now as more challenging theoretical questions. You wouldn't have any business doing a theory of the optimization of information transmission if you couldn't show that the organism is actually using the information that you're talking about. Okay. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Question back here.
So in the first part of your talk,
yes.
I essentially read it as you're coarse graining in time, and you're thinking of this as a statistical mechanics distribution, averaging over all those signals at different times. I'm wondering what's known about the way that the probabilities kind of transfer between these times.
I think what we've done is to ask about, if you want, the stationary distribution for single time slices. It's not quite the same as coarse graining in time, but you're right, we're not doing dynamics. And we started by not doing dynamics, not because we didn't think dynamics was interesting, but because we had to start somewhere. So other people, including people who've passed through this effort, have been trying to think about how do I build models for, you know, the sequence of states that the system goes through. And that's complicated because there's no reason to think that it's Markovian. In fact, you can convince yourself pretty easily from the data that it's not. And the reason, of course, is that the very, even if you keep track of the action potentials generated by each individual neuron with full accuracy, there are other variables in the system that you're not keeping track of and that can hold memory for longer times. The hope might be that the really long time correlations that you really want to do coarse graining, because the long time correlations would have to be a network effect. And so, yes, people are trying to do that, but I don't think there's anything very sharp to say.
I don't really work in this, so it's a pretty basic question. So some of these things that you're saying, how do they relate to epigenetics, or is that something that comes into play in what you're looking at?
So if I ask you, why is the concentration of a protein in a cell what it is? Say, look, all the proteins are encoded in the genome, and yet one molecule is present at concentration 100, one is at concentration 1, one is at concentration essentially 0. So what's controlling that? So the first order answer is that there are proteins that bind to the DNA, which are called transcription factors, that directly regulate whether the information is read out to make messenger RNA and that can then go on to synthesize the protein. But it's also true that, of course, you could also degrade the messenger RNA, you could control the efficiency of turning messenger RNA into protein, you can modify the proteins, there's all of that side that you could regulate. And then the other side is that, as you note, the DNA molecules have lots of proteins bound to them, and the DNA itself can be marked. And as a result, even the effectiveness of these transcription factors in binding can vary. Now, I think I could give you a claim that on the timescales of what's happening in the fly embryo, that background has to stay relatively constant, and I don't need to think about it. And that claim might or might not be true, but what I can tell you is that at the moment, we're using all of the things that our experimentalist friends can measure. So it could be that that's changing in the background, and we don't know about it in this particular case.
So you
Yes.
Yes.
Is there any sense that you can then see whether there is something physical that corresponds to them? That is to say, look for the big J's and see if you get physical connection.
Yeah. So the closest that anybody's come to this, so in the fully functioning networks while they're doing things, I don't think anybody's really done anything convincing. The closest that people have come is to do this for the pattern, spontaneous patterns of activity of the retina in the dark. And then the correlations are very short-ranged, and indeed, they really if you go through this construction, the J's correspond to coupling neurons that are physically next to each other. And so you sort of like, okay, in that case it worked. When the whole network's busy doing lots of different things, there's probably too many other variables that you've averaged over, and so all the interactions are effective. That would be my guess.
So in the plot on the left, right?
Yes.
So if you were to follow the black line exactly,
yeah.
Like how would the organism ever make a decision?
Oh, but remember this is a conditional probability, right?
Okay.
So it's saying that if I tell you the state of n minus one neurons, I can tell you the probability that the nth will be active or silent.
Yeah.
But I haven't, that's a slice, right, through the probability distribution. So for example, if the whole network were deciding between two things, if you could visualize the entire multidimensional distribution, you might find that there are two very different peaks that correspond to deciding, you know, turn left and turn right. And you couldn't tell that by looking at this plot.
Okay, well, let's thank Bill for
thanks.